Bright hope arises from the dark and makes the mighty tremble. Princes can't fail to see his mark, nor can they now dissemble. With hair like moleskin smooth and black, and mask of blue jay feathers, he vows strong doers to attack, strikes princes in all weathers. He hunts their game, he robs their gold, and him they would have slain. But he's far away, he will not stay, they seek the jay in vain.
How they were all looking at her. Risa took a step backward.
I must go to my husband, she said. That song, it has nothing to do with him. Believe me, it doesn't.
She felt their eyes on her back as she returned to the cave.
Forget them, she told herself. Dustfinger will get your message, that's all that matters, and he'll find Maggie and bring her here.
The woman who had taken her place rose without a word and lay down with the others again. Risa was so exhausted that she swayed as she kneeled on the dead leaves covering the floor. And the tears came once more. She wiped them away with her sleeve, hid her face in the fabric of her dress that smelled so familiar. Of Eleanor's house, of the old sofa where she used to sit with Maggie, telling her about this world. She began to sob. Sob so loudly that she was afraid she might have woken one of the sleeping company. Alarmed, she pressed a hand to her mouth. Risa. It was hardly more than a whisper. She raised her head. Mo was looking at her, looking at her.
I heard your voice, he whispered. She didn't know whether to laugh or to weep first. She leaned over him and covered his face with kisses, and then she both laughed and wept.
Chapter 26. Finolio's Plan. 2 days had passed since the festivities at the castle. 2 days that Finolio had spent showing Maggie every nook and cranny of Ombra. But today, he said before they set off again after eating breakfast with Minerva, today I'll show you the river. It's a steep climb down there, not very easy for my old bones, but there's nowhere better to talk in peace. And what's more, if we're in luck, you may see some water nymphs down there,
Maggie would have loved to see a water nymph. She had come upon only one so far, in a rather muddy pond in the wayless wood, and as soon as Maggie's reflection had fallen on the water, the nymph had darted away. But what exactly did Finolio want to talk about in peace? It wasn't hard to guess. What was he going to ask her to read here this time? Or rather, who was he going to ask her to read here? And where from? From another story written by Finolio himself? The path down which he led her wound its way along steeply sloping fields where farmers were working, bent double in the morning sun. How hard it must be growing enough to eat to allow you to survive the winter. And then there were all the creatures who secretly attacked your few provisions, mice, mealworms, maggots, woodlice. Life was much more difficult in Finolio's world. Yet it seemed to Maggie that with every new day, his story was spinning a magic spell around her heart, sticky as spider's webs, and enchantingly beautiful, too. Everything around her seemed so real by now. Her homesickness had almost disappeared.
Come on! Finolio's voice startled her out of her thoughts.
The river lay before them, shining in the sun, with faded flowers drifting on the water by its banks. Finolio took her hand and led her down the bank to a place where large rocks stood. Maggie hopefully leaned over the slowly flowing water, but there were no water nymphs in sight.
Well, they're timid. Too many people around. Finolio looked disapprovingly at the women doing their washing nearby.
He waved to Maggie to walk on until the voices died away and only the rippling of the water could be heard. Behind them, the roofs and towers of Ombra rose against the pale blue sky. The houses were crowded close inside the walls, like birds in a nest too small for them, and the black banners of the castle fluttered above them as if to inscribe the Laughing Prince's grief on the sky itself. Maggie clambered up onto a flat rock over the water's edge.
The river was not broad, but seemed to be deep, and its water was darker than the shadows on the opposite bank.
"Can you see one?"
Finoli almost slipped off the wet rock as he joined her. Maggie shook her head.
"Mm-mm. What's the matter?"
Finolio knew her well enough after the days and nights they'd spent together in Capricorn's house.
"Not homesick again, are you?"
"No, no." Maggie kneeled down and ran her fingers through the cold water. The previous day, Finolio had shown her Baker's Alley, the houses where the rich spice and cloth dealers lived, and every gargoyle, every carved flower, every richly adorned frieze with which the skillful stonemasons of Ombra had ornamented the buildings of the city. Judging by the pride Finolio displayed as he led Maggie past every corner of Ombra, however remote, he seemed to consider it all his own work.
"Well, perhaps not every corner,"
he admitted, as she once tried getting him to go down an alley she hadn't seen yet.
"Of course, Ombra has its ugly sides too, but there's no need for you to bother your pretty head about them."
It had been dark by the time they were back in his room under Minerva's roof, and Finolio quarreled with Rosenquartz because the glass man had spattered the fairies with ink. Even though the voices rose louder and louder, Maggie nodded off on the straw mattress that Minerva had sent up the steep staircase for her, and that now lay under the window. And suddenly, there was all that red, a dull red, shining, wet red, and her heart started beating faster and faster, ever faster, until its violent thudding woke her with a start.
"There, look!"
Finolio took her arm. Rainbow scales shimmered under the watery surface of the river. At first, Maggie almost took them for leaves, but then she saw the eyes looking at her, like human eyes, yet very different, for they had no whites. The nymph's arms looked delicate and fragile, almost transparent. Another glance, and then the scaly tail flicked in the water, and there was nothing left to be seen but a shoal of fish gliding by, silvery as a snail track, and a flock of fire elves like the elves she and Farid had seen in the forest. Farid. He had made a fiery flower blossom at her feet. A flower. Just for her. Dustfinger had certainly taught him many wonderful things.
"I think it's always the same dream, but I can't remember. I just remember the fear, as if something terrible had happened."
She turned to Finolio.
"Do you think it really has?"
"Nonsense."
Finolio brushed aside the thought like a troublesome insect.
"We must blame Rosenquartz for your bad dream. I expect the fairy sat on your forehead the night because he annoyed them. Vengeful little things, and I'm afraid it makes no difference to them who they avenge themselves on."
"I see."
Maggie dipped her fingers in the water again. It was so cold that she shivered. She heard the washerwomen laugh, and a fire elf settled on her wrist. Insect eyes stared at her out of a human face. Maggie quickly shooed away the tiny creature.
"Very sensible," Finolio said. "You want to be careful of fire elves. They'll burn your skin."
"I know. Risa told me about them."
Maggie watched the elf go. There was a sore red mark on her arm where it had settled.
"My own invention,"
explained Finolio proudly.
"They produce honey that lets you talk to fire. Very much sought after by fire eaters, but the elves attack anyone who comes too close to their nests. And few know how to set about stealing the honey without getting badly burned. In fact, now that I think of it, probably no one but Dustwinger knows."
Maggie just nodded. She had hardly been listening.
"What did you want to talk to me about? You want me to read something, don't you?"
A few faded red flowers drifted past on the water, red as dried blood. And Maggie's heart began beating so hard again that she put her hand to her breast. What was the matter with her? Finolio undid the bag at his belt and tipped a domed red stone out into his hand.
"Isn't it magnificent?"
he asked.
"I went to get it this morning while you were still asleep. It's a barrel, a reading stone. It can use it, like spectacles."
"I know. What about it?"
Maggie stroked the smooth stone with her fingertips. Mo had several like it lying on the windowsill of his workshop.
What about it? Don't be so impatient. Violante is almost as blind as a bat, and her delightful son has hidden her old reading stone, so I bought her another, even though it was a ruinous price. I hope she'll be so grateful that in return she'll tell us a few things about her late husband. Yes, yes, I know I made Cosimo up myself, but it was a long time ago that I wrote about him. To be honest, I don't remember that part particularly well. And what's more, who knows how he may have changed once this story took it into its head to go on telling itself?
A horrible foreboding came into Maggie's mind. No, he couldn't be planning to do that. Not even Finolio would think up such an idea. Or would he?
Listen, Maggie, he lowered his voice, as if the women doing their washing upstream could hear him. The two of us are going to bring Cosimo back.
Maggie sat up straight, so abruptly that she almost slipped and fell into the river.
You're crazy! Totally crazy! Cosimo's dead!
Can anyone prove it?
She didn't like Finolio's smile one little bit.
I told you his body was burned beyond recognition. Even his father wasn't sure it was really Cosimo. He waited 6 months before he would have the dead man buried in the coffin intended for his son.
But it was Cosimo, wasn't it?
Who's going to say so? It was a terrible massacre.
They say the fire raisers had been storing some kind of alchemical powder in the fortress, and Firefox set it alight to help him get away. The flames enveloped Cosimo and most of his men, and later no one could identify the dead bodies found among the ruins.
Maggie shuddered. Finolio, on the other hand, seemed greatly pleased by this idea. She couldn't believe how satisfied he looked.
But it was him. You know it was.
Maggie's voice sank to a whisper.
Finolio, we can't bring back the dead.
I know. Probably not.
There was deep regret in his voice.
Although, didn't some of the dead come back when you summoned the shadow?
No, they all fell to dust and ashes again only a few days later. Eleanor cried her eyes out. She went to Capricorn's village, even though Mo tried to persuade her not to, and there wasn't anyone there either. They'd all gone. Forever.
Finolio stared at his hands. They looked like the hands of a farmer or a craftsman, not hands that wielded only a pen.
So we can't very well, he murmured. Perhaps it's all for the best. How would a story ever work if anyone could just come back from the dead at any time? It would lead to hopeless confusion. It would wreck the suspense. No, you're right. The dead stay dead. So we won't bring Cosimo back. Just, well, someone who looks like him.
Looks like him? You are crazy, whispered Maggie. You're a total lunatic.
But her opinion did not impress Finolio in the slightest.
So what? All writers are lunatics. I promise you, I'll choose my words very carefully, so carefully, that our brand new Cosimo will be firmly convinced he is the old one. Do you see, Maggie? Even if he is only a double, he mustn't know it. On no account is he to know it. What do you think?
Maggie just shook her head. She hadn't come here to change this world. She'd only wanted to see it.
Maggie,
Finolio placed his hand on her shoulder.
You saw the Laughing Prince. He could die any day. And then what? It's not just the strolling players that the Adderhead strings up. He has his peasants' eyes put out if they catch a rabbit in the forest. He forces children to work in his silver mines until they're blind and crippled. And he's made Firefox, who is a murderer and an arsonist, his own herald.
Oh, yes? And who made him that way? You did!
Maggie angrily pushed away his hand.
You always did like your villains best. Well, yes, maybe.
Finolio shrugged as if he were powerless to do anything about it.
But what was I to do? Who wants to read a story about two benevolent princes ruling a merry band of happy, contented subjects? What kind of story would that be?
Maggie leaned over the water and fished out one of the red flowers. You like making the mud, she said quietly. All these monsters. Even Finolio had no reply to that. So they sat in silence while the women upstream spread their washing on the rocks to dry. It was still warm in the sun, in spite of the faded flowers that the river kept bringing into the bank. Finolio broke the silence at last.
Please, Maggie, he said, just this once, if you help me to get back in control of this story, I'll write you the most wonderful words to take you home again, whenever you like. Or if you change your mind because you like my world better, then I'll bring your father here for you, and your mother, and even a bookworm woman, though from all you tell me, she sounds like a frightful person.
That made Maggie laugh. Yes, Eleanor would like it here, she thought, and she was sure Risa would like to see the place again. But not Mo. No, never. She suddenly stood up and smoothed down her dress, looking up at the castle. She imagined what it would be like if the Adderhead with his salamander gaze ruled up there. She hadn't even liked the Laughing Prince much.
Maggie, believe me, said Finolio. You'd be doing something truly good. You'd be given a son back to his father, a husband back to his wife, a father back to his child. Yes, I know he's not a particularly nice child, but all the same. And you'd be helping to thwart the Adderhead's plans. Surely that's an honorable thing to do. Please, Maggie.
He looked at her almost imploringly.
Help me. It's my story after all. Believe me, I know what's best for it. Lend me your voice. Just once more.
Lend me your voice. Maggie was still looking up at the castle, but she no longer saw the towers and the black banners. She was seeing the shadow, Capricorn lying dead in the dust. All right. I'll think about it, she said. But now Farida's waiting for me.
Finolio looked at her with as much surprise as if she had suddenly sprouted wings.
Oh, is he indeed?
There was no mistaking the disapproval in his voice.
But I was going to go up to the castle with you to take her ugliness the barrel. I wanted you to hear what she has to say about Cosimo.
I promised him. They had agreed to meet outside the city gates so that Farid wouldn't have to pass the guards.
You promised? Well, never mind. You wouldn't be the first girl to keep a suitor waiting. He is not my suitor. Glad to hear it. Since your father isn't here, it's up to me to keep an eye on you after all.
Finolio looked at her gloomily.
You really have grown. The girls here marry at your age. Oh, don't look at me like that. Minerva's second daughter has been married for 5 months. She's just 14. How old is that boy? 15, 16?
Maggie did not reply. Simply turned her back on him. Chapter 27 Violante. Finolio simply persuaded Farid to go up to the castle with them.
This'll work out very well, he whispered to Maggie. He can entertain the prince's spoiled brat of a grandson and give us a chance to get Violante to talk in peace.
The outer courtyard lay as if deserted that morning. Only a few dry twigs and squashed cakes showed that there had been a party here. Grooms, blacksmiths, stable lads were all going about their work again. But an oppressive silence seemed to weigh down everyone within the walls. On recognizing Finolio, the guards of the inner castle let them pass without a word, and a group of men in gray robes, grave-faced, came toward them beneath the trees of the inner courtyard.
Physicians, muttered Finolio, uneasily watching them go. More than enough of them to cure a dozen men to death. This boat's no good.
The servant whom Finolio buttonholed outside the throne room looked pale and tired. The Prince of Sighs, he told Finolio in a whisper, had taken to his bed during his grandson's celebrations and hadn't left it since. He would not eat or drink, and he had sent a messenger to the stonemason carving his sarcophagus, telling him to hurry up with it. But they were allowed to see Violante, the prince would see neither his daughter-in-law nor his grandson. He had sent away even the physicians. He would have no one near him but his furry-faced page, Tullio.
"She's where she ought not to be again,"
the servant was whispering, as if he could be heard by the sick prince in his apartments as he led them through the castle. A carved likeness of Cosimo looked down on them in every corridor. Now that Maggie knew about Fenelio's plans, the stony eyes made her even more uncomfortable.
"They all have the same face," Farid whispered to her.
But before Maggie could explain why, the servant was beckoning them silently up a spiral staircase.
"Does Babila still ask such a high price for letting Violante into the library?"
asked Fenelio quietly as their guide stopped at his door, which was adorned with brass letters.
"Poor thing. She's given him almost all her jewelry,"
the servant whispered back.
"But there you are. He used to live in the castle of night, didn't he? Everyone knows that those who live on the other side of the forest are greedy folk, with the exception of my mistress."
"Come in," called a bad-tempered voice when the servant knocked. The room they entered was so bright it made Maggie blink after walking through all those dark passages and up the dark stairs. Daylight fell through high windows on several intricately carved desks. The man standing at the largest of them was neither young nor old, and he had black hair and brown eyes that looked at them without any cordiality as he turned to them.
"Ah, the Inkweaver,"
he said, reluctantly putting down the hare's foot he held in his hand. Maggie knew what it was for. Mo had told her often enough. Rubbing parchment with a hare's foot made it smooth. And there were the colors whose names Mo had repeated over and over to her. "Tell me again." How often she had plagued Mo with that demand. She had never tired of the sound of them. Lapis lazuli, orpiment, violet, malachite green.
"What makes them still shine like that, Mo?" she had asked. "After all, they're so old. What are they made of?"
And Mo had told her. Told her how you made them, all those wonderful colors that shone even after hundreds of years as if they had been stolen from the rainbow. Now protected from air and light, between the pages of books. To make malachite green, you pounded wild iris flowers and mixed them with yellow lead oxide. The red was made from murex shells and cochineal insects. They had so often stood together looking at the pictures in one of the valuable manuscripts that Mo was to free from the grime of many years.
"Look at those delicate tendrils," he had said. "Can you imagine how fine the pens and brushes must be to paint something like that, Maggie?"
He was always complaining that no one could make such implements anymore. And now she saw them with her own eyes. Tiny pens, as fine as hairs and brushes, whole sets of them standing in a glazed jug. Brushes that could conjure up flowers and faces, no bigger than a pinhead on parchment or paper. You moistened them with a little gum arabic to make the paint cling better. Her fingers itched to pick a brush out of the set and take it away with her for Mo. "He ought to have come just for this," she thought. "To stand here in this room." An illuminator's workshop. Fenelio's world seemed twice, three times as wonderful. Eleanor would have given one of her little fingers to be standing here now, thought Maggie. She was about to move toward one of the desks to take a closer look at it all, the brushes, the pigments, the parchment, but Fenelio held her back.
"Balbulus," he sketched a bow, "and thou is the master today."
There was no mistaking the mockery in his voice.
"The Inkweaver wants to see the Lady Violante,"
said the servant in a low voice. Babulus pointed to a door behind him.
"Well, you know where the library is. Or perhaps we had better rename it the Chamber of Forgotten Treasureth."
He lisped slightly, his tongue touching his teeth as if it didn't have enough room in his mouth.
"Violante is just looking at my latest work, or what she can see of it. I finished copying out the stories for her son last night. I never have used the parchment for other texts, I must admit, but Violante insisted."
Well, I'm sorry you had to waste your art on such frivolities,
replied Finolio, without so much as glancing at the work Balbulus had before him at the moment. For he did not seem interested in the picture either. He looked at the window, where the sky outside shone a brighter blue than any of the paint sticking to the fine brushes. But Maggie wanted to see how good Balbulus was at his art, and whether his haughty attitude was justified. Unobtrusively, she took a step forward. She saw a picture framed in gold leaf, showing a castle among green hills, a forest, magnificently dressed riders among the trees, fairies fluttering around them, and a white stag turning to flee. Never before had she seen such a picture. It glowed like stained glass, like a window placed on the parchment. She would have loved to look at it more closely, see the faces, the horses' harnesses, the flowers and clouds. But Balbulus cast her such an icy glance that she retreated, blushing.
"That poem you brought yesterday,"
said Balbulus in a bored voice as he bent over his work again.
"It was good. You ought to write such things more often. But I know you prefer writing stories for children or songs for the motley folk. And why? Just for the wind to sing your words? The spoken word is nothing. It hardly lives longer than an insect. Only the written word is eternal."
Eternal!
Finolio made the word sound as if there could be nothing more ridiculous in the world.
Nothing's eternal. And what happier fate could words have than to be sung by minstrels? Yes, of course, they change the words. They sing them slightly differently every time. But isn't that in itself wonderful? A story wearing another dress every time you hear it. What could be better? A story that grows and puts out flowers like a living thing. But look at the stories people press in books. They may last longer, yes, but they breathe only when someone opens the book. Huh? They are sound pressed between the pages, and only a voice can bring them back to life. Then they throw off sparks, Balbulus. Then they go free as birds, flying out into the world. Perhaps you're right, and the paper makes them immortal. But why should I care? Will I live on, neatly pressed between the pages with my words? Nonsense! We're none of us immortal. Even the finest words don't change that, do they?
Balbulus had listened to him without any expression on his face.
What an unusual opinion, Inkweaver, he said. For my part, I think highly of the immortality of my work, and very poorly of minstrels. But why don't you go into Violante? She'll probably have to leave soon to hear some peasant's woes or listen to a merchant complaining of the highwaymen who make the roads unsafe.
It's almost impossible to get hold of acceptable parchment these days. Robbers steal it and offer it for sale in the markets at outrageous prices.
Have you any idea how many goats must be slaughtered for me to write down one of your stories?
About one for each double spread, said Maggie, earning another icy look from Balbulus.
Clever girl, he said in a tone that made his words sound more like blame than praise. And why? Because those fools, the goat herders, drive them through thorns and prickly bushes without stopping to think that their skins will be needed for parchment.
Oh, come on, I keep telling you, said Finolio, steering Maggie and Farid toward the library door. Paper, Balbulus. Paper is the material of the future.
Paper?
She heard Balbulus mutter scornfully.
Good heavens, Inkweaver, you're even crazier than I thought.
Maggie had visited more libraries with Mo than she could count. Many had been larger than the Laughing Prince's, but few were more beautiful. You could still see that it had once been its owner's favorite place. The only trace of Cosimo here was a white stone bust. Someone had laid roses in front of it. The tapestries on the high walls were finer than those in the throne room, the sconces heavier, the colors warmer, and Maggie had seen enough in Balbulus's workshop to guess what treasures surrounded her here. They stood chained to the shelves, not spine beside spine like the books in Eleanor's library, but with the cut edge facing forward, because that's where the title was. In front of the shelves were rows of desks,
presumably reserved for the latest precious acquisitions. Books lay on them, chained like sisters in the shelves, and closed so that no harmful ray of light could fall on Balbulus's pictures. In addition, all the library windows were hung with heavy fabric. Obviously, the Prince of Sighs knew what damage sunlight did to books. Only two windows let in the light that might harm them. Her ugliness stood in front of one window, bending so low over a book that her nose almost touched the pages.
"Balbulus is getting better and better, Brianna," she said.
"He's greedy. A pearl just for letting you into your father-in-law's library."
Her maidservant was standing at the other window looking out, while Violante's son tugged at her hand.
"Brianna!"
he whined.
"Come on! This is boring! Come out into the courtyard! You promised!"
"He uses the money from the pearls to buy new pigments. How else would he get them, when no one in this castle will pay gold for anything but statues of a dead man?"
Violante jumped when Finolio closed the door behind him, guiltily hiding the book behind her back. Only when she saw who it was did her face relax.
"Finolio," she said, pushing her mousy brown hair back from her forehead, "must you scare me like that?" The mark on her face was like a paw print.
Finolio smiled and put his hand into the bag at his belt. I've brought you something. Violante's fingers closed greedily on the red stone. Her hands were small and rounded like a child's. She quickly reopened the book she had hidden behind her back and held the barrel up to one of her eyes.
"Come on, Brianna, or I'll tell them to cut off your hair!"
Jacopo took a handful of the maid's hair and pulled it so hard that she screamed.
"It's what my grandfather does. He shaves them bald, the minstrel girls and the women who live in the forest. He says they turn into owls by night and screech outside your windows until you're dead in your bed."
"Don't look at me like that," Finolio whispered to Maggie.
"I didn't invent the little whore. Here, Jacopo."
He dug his elbow imperatively into Farid's ribs as Brianna went on trying to free her hair from the child's small fingers.
"Look, I've brought someone to see you."
Jacopo let go of Brianna's hair and examined Farid with little enthusiasm.
"He doesn't have a sword,"
he pointed out.
"A sword? Who needs a sword?"
Finolio wrinkled his nose.
"Farid is a fire eater."
Brianna raised her head and looked at Farid, but Jacopo was still inspecting him as unenthusiastically as ever.
"Oh, this stone is wonderful," his mother murmured. "My old one wasn't half so good. I can make them all out, Brianna, every character. Did I ever tell you how my mother taught me to read by making up a little song for each letter?" She began to chant quietly. "A brown bear bites off a big bit of bee."
I didn't see particularly well even then, but she traced them on the floor very large for me, laying them out with flower petals or little stones. "A, B, C, the minstrel plays for me."
"No," said Brianna, "you never told me." Jacopo was still staring at Farid.
"He was at my party," he said. "He threw torches."
"That was nothing, just a children's game." Farid was looking patronizingly at the boy, as if he himself and not Jacopo were the prince's son.
"I can do other tricks, too, but I don't think you're old enough for them."
Maggie saw Brianna hide a smile as she took the barrette out of her pale red hair and pinned it up again. She did it very prettily. Farid was watching her. And for the first time in her life, Maggie wished that she had such lovely hair, although she wasn't sure that she could manage to put a barrette in it so gracefully. Luckily, Jacopo attracted Farid's attention again by clearing his throat and folding his arms. He had probably copied the mannerism from his grandfather.
"Show me, or I will have you whipped!"
The threat sounded ridiculous uttered in such a shrill voice, yet at the same time, it was more terrible than if it had come from an adult mouth.
"Oh, will you?"
Farid's face gave nothing away. He had obviously learned a thing or two from Dustfinger.
"And what do you think I'd do to you, then?"
This left Jacopo speechless. But just as he was about to appeal to his mother for support, Farid reached out his hand to the boy. "Very well, come along then." Jacopo hesitated. For a moment, Maggie was tempted to take Farid's hand herself and follow him into the courtyard, instead of listening to Finolio trying to follow a dead man's trail. But Jacopo moved faster. His pale, stubby fingers gripped Farid's brown hand tightly, and when he turned in the doorway, his face was that of a happy, perfectly ordinary little boy.
"He's going to show me tricks, did you hear?"
he said proudly, but his mother didn't even look up.
"Oh, what a wonderful stone," was all she whispered. "If only it wasn't red, if only I had one for each eye."
"Well, I'm working on a way around that, but I'm afraid I haven't found the right glassmaker yet."
With a sigh, Finolio dropped into one of the chairs invitingly arranged among the reading desks. They all bore the old coat of arms on the leather upholstery, the one where the lion was not shedding tears. And the leather of some was so worn that you could clearly tell how many hours the Laughing Prince had once spent here, until grief sapped his pleasure in books.
"A glassmaker? Why a glassmaker?"
Violante gazed at Finolio through the barrel. It looked almost as if her eye was made of fire.
"Glass can be ground to make your eyes see better, much better than through a stone, but there isn't a glazier in Ombra who knows what I'm talking about."
"Oh, I know. Only the stonemasons are good for anything in this place. Bobulus says there's not a single decent bookbinder in all Lombrica."
"I could tell you the name of a good one,"
thought Maggie instinctively, and for a moment she wished Mo were here, so much that it hurt. But her ugliness was looking at the book again.
"There are good glaziers in my father's realm," she said without glancing up. "He's had several windows in his castle filled in with glass. He had to sell off 100 of his peasants as soldiers to pay for it."
Violante seemed to consider the price well worth paying.
"I don't think I like her,"
thought Maggie, as she went slowly from desk to desk. The bindings of the books lying on them were beautiful, and she would have loved to hide at least one of them under her dress so that she could look at it in Finolio's room at her leisure. But the chips holding the chains in place were firmly riveted to the wooden covers of the books.
"You're welcome to look at them."
Her ugliness spoke to Maggie so suddenly that she jumped. Violante was still holding the red stone up to her eye, and Maggie was reminded of the blood-red jewels at the corners of the adder-head's pierced nostrils. His daughter resembled her father more than she probably knew.
"Thank you,"
murmured Maggie, and opened one. She remembered the day when Mo had shown her how to open an old book without using her fingers. He had handed her a book with two brass clasps holding its wooden covers together. She had looked at him, baffled, and then, smiling at her, he had struck the front of the book so hard with his fist, so hard that the clasps snapped open like little mouths, and the book was opened, as if by a ghostly hand. But the book that Maggie opened in the Laughing Prince's library showed no sign of age, as that other book had done. No speck of mold disfigured the parchment, no beetles or bookworms had nibbled it, like some of the manuscripts she had seen when Mo restored them. The years were not kind to parchment and paper. A book had many enemies, and in time it withered like a human body. "Which tells us, Maggie," Mo had always said, "that a book is a living thing." If only she could have shown him this one. Very, very carefully she turned the pages. Yet her mind was not entirely on what she was doing, for the wind blew Farid's voice into the room like the memory of another world. Maggie listened to what was going on outside as she snapped shut the clasps of the book again. Finolio and Violante were still talking about useless bookbinders. Neither of them was taking any notice of her, and Maggie stole over to one of the darkened windows and peered through the gap in the curtains. Her glance fell on a walled garden, beds of brightly colored flowers, and Farid standing among them, letting flames lick their way up his bare arms, just as Dustfinger had done the first time Maggie saw him breathing fire back in Eleanor's garden, before he had betrayed her. Jacopo was laughing exuberantly. He clapped and then stumbled back in alarm as Farid sent the torches whirling through the air like Catherine wheels. Maggie couldn't help smiling. Dustfinger had certainly taught him a lot, even if Farid couldn't yet breathe fire quite so high in the air as his teacher.
Books.
No, I told you, Cosimo never came in here.
Violante's voice suddenly sounded considerably sharper, and Maggie turned around.
He thought nothing of books. He loved dogs, good boots, a fast horse. There were days when he even loved his son. But I don't want to talk about him.
Laughter drifted up from the outside again. Brianna joined Maggie at the window.
The boy's a very good fire-eater, she said.
Really? Her short-sighted mistress looked at her. I thought you didn't like fire-eaters. You're always saying they're feckless folk.
This one's good? Much better than Soot-Bird's. Brianna's voice sounded husky.
I noticed him at the celebrations.
Violante, Finolio sounded impatient. Can we forget about that fire-breathing boy for a moment? Very well. So, Cosimo didn't like books. These things happen. But surely you can tell me a little more about him.
Why?
Her ugliness raised the barrel to her eye again.
Let Cosimo rest in peace. He's dead. The dead don't want to linger here. Why won't anyone understand that? And if you want to know some secret about him, well, he had none. He could talk about weapons for hours on end. He liked fire-eaters and knife-throwers and wild rides through the night. He had the smiths show him how to forge a sword, and he had fenced for hours with the guards down in the courtyard until he'd mastered every trick they knew. But when the minstrels struck up their songs, he began yawning after the first verse. He couldn't have cared for any of the songs you've written about him. He might have liked the robber songs, but as for the idea that words can be like music, making the heart beat faster, he had no ear for that. Even executions interested him more than words, although he never enjoyed them the way my father does.
Really?
Finolio sounded surprised, but by no means disappointed. Wild rides through the night, he murmured. Fast horses.
Yes, why not?
Her ugliness wasn't listening to him.
Brianna, she said, take this book. If I praise Balbulus enough for his new pictures, perhaps he'll leave it with us for a while.
Her maid took the book from her, an abstracted expression on her face, and went to the window again.
But the people loved him, didn't they?
Finolio had risen from his chair.
Cosimo was good to them, to the peasants, the poor, the strolling players.
Violante stroked the mark on her cheek. Yes, they all loved him. He was so handsome that you just had to love him. You couldn't help it. But as for the peasants, she wearily rubbed her short-sighted eyes. Do you know what he always said about them? Why are they so ugly, he asked. Ugly clothes, ugly faces. When they brought their disputes to him, he really did try to do justice fairly, but it bored him to tears. He could hardly wait to get away again, back to his father's soldiers, his horses, and his hounds.
Finolio said nothing. He looked so baffled that Maggie almost felt sorry for him.
Isn't he going to make me read aloud after all, she wondered.
And for a strange moment, she felt something like disappointment.
Come along, Brianna,
ordered her ugliness. But her maid did not stir. She was gazing down at the courtyard as if she had never seen a fire-eater before in her life. Frowning, Violante went over to her.
What are you staring at?
She asked, squinting through the window with her short-sighted eyes.
He's making flowers from fire, stammered Brianna. They start like golden buds, but then they unfold like real flowers. I once saw something like that, and I was very little.
Yes, very nice, but come along now.
Her ugliness turned and made for the door. She had an odd way of walking, with her head slightly bent, yet carrying herself very upright. Brianna took a last look out of the window before hurrying after her. Balbulus was grinding colors when they entered his workshop, blue for the sky, russet and umber for the earth. Violante whispered something to him. Presumably she was softening him up. She pointed to the book that Brianna was carrying for her.
I'll be off now, Your Highness, said Finolio,
Yes, you can go, she told him. But next time you visit me, don't ask questions about my late husband. Bring me one of the songs you write for the minstrels instead. I like them very much, particularly those songs about the robber, the man who makes my father so angry. What's his name? Oh, yes. The Blue Jay.
Finolio paled slightly under his sunburn.
How do you know I wrote those songs?
Her ugliness just laughed.
I'm the Adderhead's daughter. Have you forgotten? Of course I have my spies. They're good, too. Are you afraid I'll tell my father who wrote the songs?
Don't worry. We say only the bare minimum to each other. And he's more interested in what the songs are about than in the man who wrote them. Although, if I were you, I'd stay this side of the forest for now. Finolio bowed, forcing a smile.
I shall take your advice to heart, Highness, he said.
The door with brass letters on it latched heavily into place as Finolio pulled it shut.
Curse it,
he muttered.
Curse it, curse it.
What's the matter?
Maggie looked at him with concern. Is it what she said about Cosimo?
No, nonsense. But if Violante knows who writes the songs about the Blue Jay, then so does the Adderhead. He has many more spies than she does, and suppose he doesn't keep to his own side of the forest much longer. Well, there's still time to do something about it. Maggie, he whispered as they went down the steep spiral staircase, I told you I had a model for the Blue Jay. Do you want to guess who it was? He looked expectantly at her. I like to base my characters on real people. He whispered in conspiratorial tones. Not every writer does that, but in my experience it makes them more lifelike. Facial expressions, gestures, the way someone walks, a voice, perhaps a birthmark or a scar. I'd steal something here, something there, and then they begin to breathe, until anyone hearing or reading about them thinks they can touch them. I didn't have a wide choice for the Blue Jay. My model couldn't be too old, nor too young either, and not fat or short, of course. Heroes are never short, fat, or ugly. In real life, maybe, but never in stories. No, the Blue Jay had to be tall and good-looking, attractive to other people.
Finolio fell silent. Footsteps were coming down the stairs, quick footsteps, and Brianna appeared on the massive steps above them.
Excuse me? She said and looked around guiltily, as if she had stolen away without her mistress's knowledge. That boy, do you know who taught him to play with fire like that?
She looked at Finolio as if she wanted to hear the answer more than anything. And yet, as if at the same time, there was nothing she feared hearing more.
Do you know?
She asked again.
Do you know his name?
Dustfinger, replied Maggie, speaking for Finolio. Dustfinger taught him.
And only when she spoke the name for the second time did she realize who Brianna reminded her of. Her face and the shimmer of her red hair.
Chapter 28 The Wrong Words. Dustfinger was chasing Jink out of Roxanne's henhouse when Brianna came riding into the yard. The sight of her almost stopped his heart. The dress she wore made her look like a rich merchant's daughter. Since when did maidservants wear such clothes? And the horse she was riding didn't suit this place either, with its expensive harness, its gold-studded saddle, and the deep black coat that shone as if three grooms had spent all day brushing it. A soldier in the Laughing Prince's livery rode with her. He scrutinized the simple house in the fields, his face expressionless. But Brianna looked at Dustfinger. She thrust out her chin, just as her mother so often did, straightened the barrette in her hair, and looked at him. He wished he could have made himself invisible. How hostile her glance was. Her expression both adult and that of an injured child. She was so like her mother. The soldier helped her to dismount and then took his horse to drink at the well, acting as if he had neither eyes nor ears. Roxanne came out of the house. Brianna's arrival obviously surprised her as much as him.
Why didn't you tell me he was back?
Brianna snapped. Roxanne opened her mouth,
and shot it again. "Go on, say something, Dustfinger," he told himself. The marten leaped off his shoulder and disappeared behind the stable.
"I asked her not to."
How hoarse his voice sounded.
"I thought I'd rather tell you myself."
"Bet your father is a coward," he added to himself. "Afraid of his own daughter." She was looking at him so angrily, in exactly her old way. Except that now, she was too grown up to hit him. "I saw that boy," she said. "He was at the festival, and today he was breathing fire for Jacopo. He did it, just like you." Dustfinger saw Farid appear. He stayed behind Roxanne. But Jihan pushed past him, glanced anxiously at the soldier, and then ran to his sister.
"Where did you get that horse?"
he asked. "Violante gave it to me as thanks for taking her with me by night to see the strolling players."
"You take her with you?"
Roxanne sounded concerned.
"Why not? She loves their shows, and the Black Prince says it's all right."
Brianna didn't look at her mother. Farid went over to Dustfinger.
"What does she want here?"
he whispered.
"She is her ugliness's maid."
"And my daughter, too," replied Dustfinger. Farid stared incredulously at Brianna, but she took no notice of him. It was on her father's account that she had come.
10 years,
she said accusingly.
"You stayed away for 10 years, and now you just come back, just like that. Everyone said you were dead. They said you'd molded away in the Adderhead's dungeons. They said the Fire Razors had handed you over to him because you wouldn't tell them all your secrets."
"I did tell them," said Dustfinger tonelessly. "Almost all my secrets." "And they used them to set another world on fire," he added in his thoughts. "A world without a door to let me out again, so that I could come back."
"I dreamed of you!"
Brianna's voice rose so high that her horse shied away.
"I dreamed the men-at-arms tied you to a stake and burned you. I could smell the smoke and hear you trying to talk to the fire, but it wouldn't obey you, and the flames devoured you. I had that dream almost every night. I still do. I was afraid of going to sleep for 10 whole years. And now here you are, hale and hearty, as if nothing happened. Where have you been?"
Dustfinger glanced at Roxanne. I saw the same question in her eyes.
"I couldn't come back," he said. "I couldn't. I tried. Believe me, I tried."
The wrong words. They were true 100 times over, yet it sounded like a lie. Hadn't he always known it? Words are useless. Times they might sound wonderful, but they let you down the moment you really needed them. You could never find the right words, never. And where would you look for them? The heart is as silent as a fish, however much the tongue tries to give it a voice. Brianna turned her back on him and buried her face in her horse's mane, while the soldier went on standing by the well, acting as if he were nothing but thin air. "Well, that's what I wish I was too," thought Dustfinger. "Just thin air."
"But it's the truth. He couldn't come back."
Farid stationed himself protectively in front of Dustfinger.
"There wasn't any way. It's exactly like he says. He was in an entirely different world. But it's as real as this one. There are many, many worlds. They're all different. But they're written down in books."
Brianna turned to look at him.
"Do I look like a little girl who still believes in fairy tales?"
she asked scornfully.
"Once, when he stayed away so long that my mother's eyes were red with crying every morning, the other strolling players told me stories about him. They said he was talking to the fairies, or he'd gone to see the giants, or he's down at the bottom of the sea looking for a fire that even water can't put out. I didn't believe the stories even then, but I liked them. Now, I don't. I'm not a little girl anymore. Not by any means. Help me mount my horse,"
she ordered the soldier. He obeyed without a word. Jihan stared at the sword swinging from his belt.
"Stay and eat with us,"
said Roxanne. But Brianna just shook her head and turned her horse in silence. The soldier winked at Jihan, who was still gazing at his sword. They rode away on their horses, which seemed much too large for the narrow, stony path leading to Roxanne's farm.
Roxanne took Jihan indoors with her, but Dustfinger stayed out by the stable until the two riders had disappeared into the hills. Farid's voice quivered with indignation when he finally broke the silence.
But you really couldn't come back!
No, but you must admit that your story didn't sound very convincing.
It's exactly what happened all the same!
Dustfinger shrugged and looked at the place in the distance where his daughter had disappeared.
Sometimes, you and I think I only dream it all, he murmured.
A chicken squawked angrily behind them.
Where the devil is Jink? With a curse, Dustfinger opened the stable door. A white hen fluttered past him into the open. Another fowl lay in the straw, her feathers bloody. The marten was sitting beside her.
Jink! Dustfinger scolded.
Damn it, didn't I tell you to leave the chickens alone?
The marten just looked at him. Feathers were sticking to the animal's muzzle.
He stretched, raised his bushy tail, came to Dustfinger, and rubbed against his legs like a cat.
Well, what do you know? Whispered Dustfinger. Hello, Gwen. His death was back.
Chapter 29 New Masters. The Prince of Sighs, once the Laughing Prince, died scarcely a day after Meggie had been to the castle with Finolio. He died at dawn, and the men-at-arms rode into Ombra 3 days later. Meggie was in the marketplace with Minerva when they came. After her father-in-law's death, Violante had ordered the guard at the city gate to be doubled, but there were so many men-at-arms that the guards let them in without offering any resistance. The piper rode at their lead, his silver nose like a beak in the middle of his face, as shiny as if he had polished it up specially for the occasion. The narrow streets echoed with the snorting of horses, and it was quiet as the mounted men appeared among the buildings. The street cries of traders, the voices of women crowding around the stalls, all fell silent when the piper reined in his horse and disapprovingly scrutinized the crowd.
Mengwei!
He called. His voice sounded oddly strained, but what else would you expect of a man who had no nose?
Mengwei for the envoy of the Anarhead! We are here to pay his last respects to your dead prince, and ensure that his grandson takes his rightful place as his heir.
The silence continued, but then a single voice was raised.
Thursday's market day in Umbra. Always was. So if you gentlemen would like to dismount, we can get on with it.
The piper looked for the speaker among the faces staring up at him. But the man was hidden in the crowd. A murmur of agreement rose in the marketplace.
Oh! So that's it!
Cried the piper through the confused voices.
You think we rode right through that accursed forest just to dismount here and make our way through a rabble of stinking peasants? As soon as the cat's dead, the mice dance on the table. But I have news for you. There's a cat in your miserable town again. A cat with sharper claws than the old one!
Without another word, he turned in the saddle, raised his black-gloved hand, and gave his men a signal. Then, he rode his horse straight into the crowd. The silence that had been weighing down so heavily on the marketplace was torn like rending cloth. Screams rose in its enclosed space. More and more horsemen rode in from among the houses around it, so heavily armed that they looked like iron reptiles, their helmets drawn so far down that you could see only their mouths and their eyes between the nose guard and rim. There was a clinking of spurs, a clashing of greaves and breastplates, so brightly polished that they reflected the crowd's horrified faces. Minerva pushed her children out of the way. Despina stumbled, and Meggie was going to her aid when she herself tripped over a couple of cabbages and fell flat. A stranger pulled her to her feet just before the piper rode her down. Meggie heard his horse snorting above her, felt his gleaming spurs brush her shoulder. She took shelter behind a potter's overturned stall, although she cut her hands on its broken pots. Trembling, she crouched among the shards, surrounded by smashed barrels and sacks that had burst open, watching helplessly as others less lucky fell under the horse's hooves. The mounted men struck out at many in the crowd with their feet or the shafts of their spears. Horses shied, reared, and kicked at pots and people's heads. Then, just as suddenly as they had come, the men-at-arms were gone.
Only the sound of the horse's hooves could still be heard as they rode fast up the street to the castle.